Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, December 8, 2004. At WBAI New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. A policy forum on Capitol Hill today about voting irregularities in Ohio. Not a single Republican attends. While the worst anti-immigrant provisions are stripped from the House 9/11 bill, Republicans say they'll continue to push for these measures to become law. And we look at one community in California's fight to stop their water from being privatized. And other stories from around the country and around the world right after these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Ukraine's parliament adopted electoral and constitutional changes today in a compromise intended to defuse the nation's political crisis. The vote came as a surprise after days of political maneuvering and massive street protests following the disputed November 21st presidential runoff election. In the final version, the Ukrainian president no longer has the power to appoint his own government, but keeps the right to reject parliamentary nominees for the top three positions. Parliament also earns the right to appoint all other cabinet positions without presidential approval. The Ukrainian Supreme Court annulled last month's election, won by Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych, and ordered a new ballot on December the 26th. To prevent electoral fraud in the new ballot, restrictions have been placed on absentee voting. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld met today with troops in Kuwait who are awaiting deployment to Iraq. They asked Rumsfeld why they have to rummage through landfills looking for scrap metal to use as armor for their vehicles. Emily Freifield has more.
A question and answer session followed Rumsfeld's speech, during which soldiers posed direct, insistent questions regarding inadequate armor and unequal access to equipment. They asked how much longer the Army would use the stop-loss program to prevent eligible service members from retiring, to which Rumsfeld replied that it's simply a fact of life for soldiers at time of war. According to the Associated Press, the soldiers in attendance showed their approval by cheering after some of the questions that seemed to stump Rumsfeld. In response to a question about having weakly armored vehicles, Rumsfeld responded, "You go to war with the army you have, not the one you might want." Nancy Lesson, co-founder of Military Families Speak Out, shares her delight in hearing that soldiers are beginning to take a stand against insufficient equipment.
It was wonderful to hear that the soldiers are speaking out about this issue of soldiers driving in unarmored Humvees has haunted families and soldiers.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Emily Freifeld.
Today was the final day in the refugee hearing of Jeremy Hensman, a former U.S. Marine who left Fort Bragg for Canada earlier this year to avoid service in Iraq. His application for conscientious objector status was denied in 2003. Kristen Schwartz reports from CKLN in Toronto.
The hearing's adjudicator refused to hear Mr. Hensman's first argument that the war against Iraq was itself an illegal war. However, his lawyer was able to argue that the prosecution of the war violates the Geneva Conventions. Called as a witness was former Marine Sergeant Jimmy Massey, according to lawyer Jeffrey House.
And he basically testified that they slaughtered 32 people, cars would come up to his checkpoint and they would pour 200 to 500 rounds into the automobile if the person didn't stop quickly enough, and that they killed the person who had his hands up and was saying, I surrender.
Jeremy Hensman is one of at least 7 people who've deserted the U.S. forces and are in Canada. Jeff House estimates that 100 others have contacted him for information about following the same path. The decision of the Immigration and Refugee Board may come as early as February 2005. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Kristen Schwartz at CKLN in Toronto.
A Walmart store in rural Northern California was forced to settle with protesters defending their right to gather signatures and to exercise peaceful protest in front of the store. Annie Esposito reports from KZYX Radio.
The store manager of the Ukiah Walmart made citizens arrests, and the activists calling themselves the Walmart 8 sued the big retailer. They recently agreed to a settlement of $90,000 after 4.5 years in the court system. The drama began in February 2000 when a local Green Party member was collecting signatures for a petition in front of the big box. Richard Johnson says he was not bothering shoppers, but he did refuse to stand aside in one small designated area. The day after he was arrested, 8 other local Greens showed up to protest Johnson's jailing. They were also arrested. Attorney for Ukiah's Walmart 8, Mark Marin, encouraged the group to accept the settlement. The appellate decision was published and is now a precedent for others to cite, establishing that it's not a criminal offense to refuse to follow store policy restricting free speech. The cash settlement may also deter other Walmart managers from making citizens arrests in the future. The court found that rather than an ordinary store, the large Walmart is more like a mall where people gather and free speech is protected. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Annie Esposito in Northern California.
President Bush signed a $388 billion legislative package today that covers the spending of every federal agency except the Pentagon and Department of Homeland Security. Congress sent the measure, which covers the fiscal year that began October the 1st, to the president yesterday. Congress passed the package November 20th, but lawmakers delayed sending it to the White House until they overturned language that would have made it easier for some members of Congress and their aides to enter Internal Revenue Service offices and see income tax returns. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers, held a policy forum on Capitol Hill today on voting irregularities in Ohio and other states. No Republican lawmakers attended the forum. Mitch Jesrich was there, and he brings us the story.
The 2004 election is not past tense. We need emergency attention in Ohio now.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson put his support behind the Green and Libertarian Party's efforts for a recount of the presidential vote in Ohio and investigations into voting irregularities across the nation. Jackson testified at a Democratic policy forum on Capitol Hill.
Silence is betrayal. I continue to urge the Kerry campaign, the DNC, the Democratic Party, those who depend upon the vote of African Americans, Latinos, people of color, and the young, those that profess to have love for freedom and dignity of any party.
The forum was arranged by the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers of Detroit. It was not an official congressional hearing because the Republican leadership did not endorse it. Not a single Republican lawmaker was in attendance, and neither was Representative Dennis Kucinich of Ohio. Democratic lawmakers present were mostly members from the Congressional Black Caucus. Susan Pruitt, co-founder of Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections, testified of what she saw on election night.
I went to four precincts on the east side of Columbus, inner city, African American, low income, driving park precinct, lines 4 to 6 hours long, people waiting to vote, cold, rainy day. City employees came, threatened to tow their cars because they'd been there too long. Why were they there too long? They didn't have enough voting machines. They were intentionally suppressed in their vote.
Pruitt and others testified that waiting in such long lines and severe weather were especially difficult for some elderly and disabled voters. Other complaints include malfunctioning computer and optical scan voting machines. The Green and Libertarian presidential candidates are requesting a statewide recount. David Cobb ran for president with the Green Party.
There has been a series of steps along the creation of democracy, and we are not done. We are not done in this country. We have not yet perfected democracy. We are moving forward, but we still have miles to travel.
Cobb and others were successful in raising the $113,000 needed to pay for a recount, but such a request can't be made until after the certification of the votes, which happened on Monday, December 6th, 34 days after the elections. With Ohio's electors set to meet just 1 week later on the 13th, attorney John Boniface, who is representing both the Green and Libertarian candidates, accuses Ohio Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell, who declined the invitation to testify at today's forum, of purposefully delaying the recount.
He intentionally allowed no time for a recount to occur before he sent out the certificates to the presidential electors on December the 7th and before the Electoral College meets on December the 13th. Mr. Blackwell, who also serves as chair of the Bush-Cheney 2004 campaign in Ohio, has done everything he can to push through a slate of electors based on an untested initial count of the vote. He should be stopped.
Still, Boniface says that the recount will go on.
The United States Congress will receive the votes of two competing sets of presidential electors from the state of Ohio when it convenes on January 6, 2005, to formally receive the Electoral College votes. One slate will be chosen by Mr. Blackwell. The other will be chosen by the will of the people of Ohio. We will have a recount, and the fight will go on.
Most lawmakers in attendance said their interest in the forum wasn't to change the outcome of the elections, but to ensure people continue to have the unfettered right to vote. Representative Conyers said he would hold another forum on voting irregularities in Ohio. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
Today, Congress is poised to send the 9/11 Intelligence Reform Bill to the White House. Last night, the House approved the bill after weeks of debate. Many anti-immigrant provisions were stripped down, but as Dolores Bernal reports, Republicans are not about to give up pushing for legislation that targets undocumented workers.
Today, Democrats and Republicans in Congress congratulated each other for finally reaching an agreement on the 9/11 Intelligence Reform Bill, which is likely to pass the Senate today. Last night, a divided House was able to approve the intelligence bill by a 336-75 vote. The new legislation calls for the creation of a Civil Liberties Board, which will seek to protect American civil liberties, although critics say that it has limited authority. The bill also calls for the creation of a National Counterterrorism Center, which will improve counterterrorism planning, and the position of Director of National Intelligence, which will oversee the FBI, CIA, and the other 13 spy agencies. The DNI will also be responsible for the yearly $40 billion spent in intelligence. Democrat Senator Joe Lieberman from Connecticut was one of the bill's chief authors.
No one is clearly in charge of the hunt for Osama bin Laden. No one has had the authority to knit together the efforts of the 15 disparate agencies working on intelligence for the American people. And therefore, no one has ultimately been accountable for the deadly mistakes that have been made. This legislation changes all of that.
The other co-author of the bill, Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, addressed the president of the Senate, but couldn't clarify whether the legislation would actually help.
The Intelligence Reform Act will help us prevent another 9/11. I am not saying, Mr. President, that this legislation will prevent future terrorist attacks.
The bill also includes tougher border security measures, particularly along the U.S.-Mexico border. However, many of the bill's provisions that had caused an uproar among civil rights and immigration advocates were stripped from the bill. These include denying driver licenses to undocumented immigrants, tightening the asylum process, and giving immigration law enforcement powers to state and municipal police forces. The anti-immigration provisions had been proposed by Republican James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin.
I will introduce legislation on the first day of the 109th Congress, January 4th, that places into law the key provisions that were stripped from the conference report on the intelligence bill.
The debate over issuing driver's license to undocumented workers, as well as adding more red tape to the asylum process and building a fence along the U.S.-Mexico border near San Diego, are topics that Republicans like Sensenbrenner will continue to push for next year.
We're doing this to stop the next terrorists and to take necessary steps to protect the American people. The bill will address the three most critical elements, including real driver's license reform, tightening our asylum laws to stop exploitation by terrorists, and finishing the fence on California's border with Mexico.
Immigration advocates say that Sensenbrenner is trying to make a bigger deal out of the driver's licenses issue than it actually is. John Friedland is an immigration lawyer with the National Immigration Center.
All of the hijackers came to the U.S. with valid immigration documents. So a law that, like the one that Sensenbrenner wants, which would prevent undocumented immigrants from getting driver's licenses, would have had no effect on the terrorists' ability to get licenses.
Congressman Tom Davis of Virginia, a Sensenbrenner supporter, talked about the 25 Indonesian citizens who were imprisoned a few weeks ago for asylum fraud. He argues that tighter measures in the asylum process will help prevent terrorists from planning future attacks. At the end of the press conference, Free Speech Radio News asked Congressman Davis if the Indonesian detainees had been planning any terrorist attacks.
You know, I don't know if any of them were. I think they were doing it for profit.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Dolores Bernal.
The Iraqi resistance continues to operate in the razed city of Fallujah. Reports coming in to the Iraqi newspaper Mafkarat al-Islam report that the resistance has been targeting U.S. forces as they carry out raids and searches in Fallujah neighborhoods. Active U.S. patrols are also continuing in Fallujah under the cover of U.S. fighter aircrafts. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, the resistance attacked a marketplace with mortar shells because it said the goods being sold by the U.S.-installed Iraqi National Guard were plundered from residents of Fallujah. And as our correspondents Salam Talib and Dar Jamil in Baghdad report, Baghdad is a city on the point of revolt as daily life grows more unbearable.
Iraq currently has an unemployment rate of 70%. With a gas shortage causing the prices of even basic foodstuffs to rise dramatically. If the monthly food ration ceased to be distributed, it is estimated that 25% of Iraqis would starve to death. Raja is a 70-year-old grandmother who has cancer. She lives in a small room with her two daughters, her son Ali, who has a mental disability, and her 20-year-old granddaughter, who is the sole supporter of their family.
هم هم فقرة هم هم أجرين كان أنا قاعدة ببلاش هم هم أجرين
I don't own this house. Others own it with me. They can't help me because they are poor too. Now the other people who own the house with me, they want to sell the house. I was in the hospital and my children were begging people to give money since I was in the hospital, but nobody could give them anything to help.
Other Iraqis are furious at the situation their country is in. Saad Samer, a 22-year-old college student at Baghdad University.
Anyway, now out of Iraq, he can't imagine what the life looks like. No petrol, no gas, no kerosene, no electricity, no water. Imagine the life. I think the Baghdad, maybe Iraq, after some days, it's explodes. The people explode, not just the bomb.
Saad recently returned to his country after having been abroad for 7 months. He found things worse than he could have imagined.
7 months, I go to Australia. The life not like this. As day after day be worse, 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 worse. When I leave Iraq, it's the 1 liter of petrol like 250 dinars just. Now it's more than 1,000. That means like $1 for 1 liter. Imagine this in Iraq with on the petrol everywhere. When you go, you found it underground everywhere. Imagine this in Iraq. It's a terrible situation. No one can imagine this situation in Iraq.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dar Jamil with Salam Talib in Baghdad, Iraq.
New York State passed drug reform legislation that slightly lessened the harshest drug policies in the country. Leanne Caldwell reports from New York City.
Years of attempts to change New York's drug sentencing laws ended for now. The laws, also known as the Rockefeller drug laws, were enacted in 1973 under then-Governor Nelson A. Rockefeller. The state, with the approval of Governor George Pataki, passed legislation to restructure severe sentencing guidelines. Among the highlights is the reduction of mandatory sentences of most drug felonies. The most serious offenders of A1 drug felonies currently receive 15 years to life in prison. New legislation gives 8 to 20 years. More than 400 offenders currently imprisoned for these crimes can file to have their case reevaluated to comply with the new guidelines. The felony conviction of possession for cocaine and heroin will increase from 4 ounces to 8 ounces, and the conviction of selling will also increase from 2 to 4 ounces. And judges will now have discretion on sentencing and treatment options. To pass the legislation, concessions were made on both sides. Advocates for drug reform like Michael Blaine, executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, are pleased with the first step, but they will push for more.
Full judicial discretion, sentence reduction, full sentence reduction, full retroactivity, and lots and lots and lots of treatment to begin to repair and reduce some of the harm that's been done by the war on drugs here in the state of New York.
Many Republicans, including Governor Pataki, wanted to include enhancements, which include stricter penalties for gun possession, drug possession near a school zone, and kingpin legislation. FSRN spoke with Craig Miller, the communications director for Republican State Senator Dale Volker and chairman of the Civil and Criminal Codes Committee, over the telephone. He said enhancements were a poison pill for the Democrats, so they removed the proposal. Shifts throughout the state might attribute to these drug law reforms. David Soares beat the incumbent for Albany District Attorney seat. He campaigned heavily on drug policy reform. And in Manhattan on Monday, District Attorney Robert Morgenthau called for overhauling the laws. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Public comment took place yesterday in Felton, California, over a proposed buyout by the German energy giant RWE of the local water system. For 2 years, residents of Felton have been fighting plans for water privatization. This comes as, last weekend, the Nicaragua Network held its national leadership meeting in Santa Cruz. High on the agenda was the issue of water privatization and networking between communities struggling to control their natural resources. FSRN reporter Vinnie Lombardo looks at how citizens are reaching across the globe in the fight to retake their water.
Water has long been considered part of the global commons. It's a public good. It belongs to all of us.
Juliet Beck of Public Citizens Water for All campaign thinks water is a human right and must be held for the benefit of communities. Currently, 5% of the global water supply is in private hands. More than a billion people lack access to pure water, and according to the World Health Organization, 1.7 million deaths a year result from unsafe water and poor sanitation. Clean water advocates like Beck say this figure is more than three times as high.
This is only meant that multinational corporations are looking to make big bucks off this crisis, and they are pushing an agenda of privatizing water.
In Nicaragua, where Martin Vargas lives, private ownership of public resources is forbidden by the Constitution. But provisions of a $13.9 million loan from the Inter-America Development Bank have forced the Nicaraguan government to transfer public water control to private interests. There, power companies are interested in owning water, Vargas says, to create hydroelectricity. But with unemployment in Nicaragua at about 80%, no one can afford to pay the high bills.
The experience we've had is that we don't want them to privatize because they are taking food from us directly in Nicaragua. What we want to say in this moment that we are here is that the transnational businesses are just looking for a way to take money out of Nicaragua.
The same is true for communities in the U.S. where water barons have also taken root. While about 85% of water utilities are still publicly owned, more and more communities around the country are facing water takeovers. Again, Juliet Beck of Public Citizen.
Well, people in the United States have a lot to learn from our friends and allies and movements all around the world that have been dealing with the World Bank-enforced privatizations, places like the Philippines and Nicaragua and Bolivia, South Africa. All of these countries have been dealing with many of the same companies that are now setting their sights on water utilities in the United States.
Last night in Felton, California, over 100 people turned out before the Public Utilities Commission to voice frustration about a buyout of their water system. 2 years ago, RWE, through its Thames Water Holdings, swallowed up American Water Works and its many subsidiaries, including California American Water, or CalAm. Almost immediately after the acquisition, RWE dramatically increased rates to Felton's 1,300 ratepayers. Ty Stills is a Felton resident and member of FLO, Friends of Locally Owned Water.
Since RWE bought CalAm and CalAm's been running the water district, this community has really come together to discuss the management of our local natural resource. This community is committed to owning and managing our own local natural resource. I'd like the PUC to be fully aware that we have more than enough brain power and money power to take over this district.
In Monterra, located about 20 miles south of San Francisco, townspeople succeeded in reclaiming their municipal water system from RWE. Felton residents hope to accomplish the same and are seeking a bond measure from the County Board of Supervisors, which will be voted on in January. For FSRN, I'm Vinnie Lombardo in Santa Cruz, California.
Federal judge today ruled that a lawsuit that seeks to strike down Oklahoma's anti-gay adoption laws may proceed. Last May, Oklahoma Governor Brad Henry signed legislation barring adoptions by gay couples from out of state. Same-sex Oklahoma couples were already prevented from adopting, although single gay and lesbians are allowed to become the parent of adoptive children. The new law removes a loophole that had allowed same-sex partners in states where co-adoption is legal to seek children in Oklahoma. And while Americans overwhelmingly voted against gay marriage in several states on Election Day, most say they're in favor of equal legal rights regardless of a person's sexuality. In 49 states, same-sex couples and often single gay people are allowed to adopt children, but there's one holdout. As FSRN's Andrew Stelzer reports from Tampa, more than 20 social justice groups in Florida have formed the Coalition for Fair Adoption and are determined to tear down a 27-year-old law that they say accomplishes nothing more than hurting children and breaking up happy families.
I am a mama in every way that matters.
Kathy James is with Gay Parents of Tampa Bay. She's the partner of a woman who has a 4-year-old son.
Yet if my partner of 10 years, his biological mom, died tomorrow, every one of you that is heterosexual would be eligible to adopt him, and I would not. My son would be placed in the foster care system and cost the taxpayers of Florida tens of thousands of dollars over the next 14 years. I would not even have the legal standing to request visitation. This is a family values issue if ever there was one.
There are two main types of families that are restricted because of Florida's ban on gay adoption: same-sex couples and people who want to adopt foster children who have no biological parents in their lives. Becky Steele is with the Tampa ACLU.
Florida's adoption ban serves no legitimate public purpose. This law was passed in 1977 at the height of Anita Bryant's anti-gay campaign. The purpose of the law was not to protect children, but rather to punish people for being homosexual. The Senate sponsor even said, "We're trying to send a message. We're really tired of you. We wish you'd go back in the closet."
Gay people are allowed to be foster parents in Florida, which Steele says shows that the state recognizes they can be good parents. In some cases, judges have awarded unusual permanent foster parent designations to same-sex couples to circumvent the law. There are currently more than 4,500 children eligible for adoption in the state of Florida. Opponents of the gay adoption ban, like Steele, say these children are being denied loving homes.
The only group of people who are categorically banned from adopting are gay people. Not child abusers, not substance abusers, not even terrorists are categorically barred from adoption. Single people can adopt. What the courts are asked to do for every other category except for gay people is what should be done: examine adoptions on a case-by-case basis to determine whether it's in the best interest of the child to be adopted by that parent.
Last month, the ACLU took a challenge of the ban to the U.S. Supreme Court. A decision is expected in early January whether to hear the case filed on behalf of four gay men in Florida raising foster children they cannot legally adopt. The Federal Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit narrowly upheld the law by a vote of 6-6. The judge who wrote the original decision upholding the ban and voted against reconsideration even went so far as to note that the ban was bad policy and said that if he were a member of the Florida legislature, he would be opposed to the law. The coalition is now concentrating on educating state legislators, some of whom, like Republican Florida House member Faye Culp, admitted at a candidates forum in October that she wasn't even aware the ban existed.
I have a son who is gay. If something happened to his brother, who doesn't have children yet, but maybe they might someday, I can think of no other person who would be able to care for my other son's children. It is a very complicated issue, but I would certainly want to discuss that with a lot of different people before we changed anything right now. I do not know exactly what the Florida statutes have in them regarding that issue.
Supporters of the gay adoption ban say that the best way for a child to be raised is with a man and a woman, and while the new coalition members disagree with this point, Megan Schipanek, the biological parent of a daughter who's being raised in a two-mother household, says advocates may have to compromise their principles and rely on the argument that living with loving gay parents is better than being moved from one group home to the next.
It'll be framed as best for the children in foster care. These kids were throwaways anyway, they don't have anything anyway, so let's go ahead and let the gay people adopt. But through that, I think we're going to see a lot of good come out of it. A lot of kids who don't have homes right now have loving homes.
For FSRN, from WMNF Radio in Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.